Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Captain.
How you doing, Francis?
I'm doing well. You're not really the captain. The real captain, you know who the first captain in my life was?
Tennille.
You know what? You're probably right. Second captain in my life. I thought she was hot back then.
She was hot.
I was only like 9, but I thought she was delightful. Muskrat Love, wasn't that theirs, Captain and Tennille?
Love will keep us together.
Oh, my goodness. What does a muskrat have to do? I don't know. Captain Crunch is in the news.
Captain.
You're right.
Captain.
That's because it's so artificial, there's not even a real captain. It's Cap'n.
You know what my
wife... it's like chocolatey flavored sauce? There's no real captain involved.
You know what my wife says whenever she sees Captain Crunch?
What?
Why are his eyebrows on his hat? That's really, really
That's
disturbing.
Hurt. That's got to hurt.
Why do you have eyebrows on your hat?
Do you know why? Do you know why his eyes are so wide? Because he's on a sugar rush. That's why the captain's eyes are up in his head.
I thought it was because the roof of his mouth was aching from having
All right.
two bowls.
Captain Crunch makes the news. Evidently, somebody sued Captain Crunch. On May 21st, a judge of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of California dismissed a complaint filed by a woman who said she had purchased Captain Crunch with crunchberries because she believed it contained real fruit. The plaintiff, Janine Sugawara, alleged that she had only recently learned, to her dismay, that said berries were in fact simply brightly colored cereal balls. Although the product did contain some strawberry fruit concentrate, it was not otherwise redeemed by fruit. She sued on behalf of herself and all similarly situated consumers. That would be idiots around the world. Suing on behalf of all the idiots.
You know how all that's right in the world? Like there's just a little bit of sensible left in the world. This case was thrown out of court.
Do you know how stupid you have to be to get me to defend Captain Crunch? You know, I always remember my sister. my sister, valedictorian of her law school class, finished college in 3 years. Mm-hmm. Was the youngest judge ever elevated to the bench in the state of New Jersey. I remember once when she was in college and I was a teen, a young teen, and we were watching the San Giorgio spaghetti commercial, I believe it was, where mm-hmm. they were in Italy, like harvesting the spaghetti off the trees.
Yes.
And I had been on the air for about 6 months and was sitting watching TV with my brilliant sister Francine, who says, "Wait a second, spaghetti doesn't grow on trees." And I remember being 12 and saying, no, it doesn't. It's a joke.
Okay. It is shameful. Okay, I would be so embarrassed to even file this suit. Okay.
Well, you have to wonder if the woman's just trying to harass them. But I don't think so.
Of course she is.
I think she's just trying to get money.
I think she's just kind of trying to get money. And you know what, ma'am, while you're at it, there are also no church bells in Ding Dongs. Okay, there's no.
And they don't even ring if you shake them.
Are we this stupid as a society?
But, you know, as long as we're talking about Captain Crunch, we may as well criticize him. first of all, I know that I have seen you occasionally.
I must admit, peanut butter Captain Crunch, one of my guilty pleasures.
Yeah, well, all things in moderation, including moderation itself, I guess. But I went to the Captain Crunch.
Who doesn't like peanut butter Captain Crunch?
I haven't had it in many, many years, but I do remember liking it the last time I had it. So there's a shout out for
him. I had a roommate once when I was back in college.
Yeah.
And he used to take a salad bowl out of the cupboard. Pour 3/4 of a box of Captain Crunch.
Oh, I know. I know this roommate. I saw that happen.
Into a bowl. Take a quart of milk. Pour it into the bowl as well. And one of the things that you learn about, that if you're a kid, you learn about Captain Crunch, the regular Captain Crunch now, we're not talking about the peanut butter Captain Crunch, is that you learn this early on. You really can only have one bowl of Captain Crunch. The second bowl of Captain Crunch will destroy the roof of your mouth. And what he used to say is he would get to a point where he would get so torn up in the roof of his mouth that he would reach a tolerance level. So by the time he got to what would the equivalent of would be of the second bowl of Captain Crunch and got through it, he would have hurt himself so gravely with the roof of his mouth that he would have developed an immunity to it and be able to thusly finish the rest of the box.
And for the folks at General Mills Legal Department, that was a fictional story made up by Mark Pascal. I saw that myself.
Just an awful, awful self-mutilation.
I want to share with you, look, Captain Crunch, I had it as breakfast cereal when I was a kid. Have it as a snack. You know, as an adult, you do.
Well, you just need to know what it is. You need to know that it's a dessert, that it's a treat, that it's a something that's not good for you. That
It's not that it can't be a part of a healthy breakfast, so long as your idea of a healthy breakfast would include 6 chocolate chip cookies. you know that can be part of a healthy breakfast if you have bacon, eggs, toast, and vegetables.
Well, let's call it the unhealthy part of a healthy breakfast.
Well, what's funny is I went to the website, and the website is great because if you go to Captain Crunch has a website, it's this Crunch Island, right? They have Crunch Island, and there's a little resource there's parents section of Crunch Island where parents can go for valuable information on building a healthy
Crunch Island
diet for your kids, and nowhere does it contain the advice: don't give your kids this. But what I thought was interesting about Crunch Island is you can get the ingredients for everything, and the number two ingredient in all they're listed in proportion of what's in there.
Mm.
So the number one ingredient is usually some whatever wheat base they use, and the number two ingredient is always sugar in every single one of them. So there's as much sugar as if you were giving your kids cookies, okay? Maybe more, depending on the cookie. So I just don't understand.
And you know what? Francis and I are not saying never give your kid cookies because that's not.
Yeah, and you know
not,
what?
That's not what we think.
Once in a blue moon, cookies for breakfast isn't so bad. But don't kid yourself into thinking that.
Right. Don't fool yourself into thinking that you're giving your kids everything they need by giving them breakfast.
Well, and look, in these cookies, they've added some vitamins and minerals.
Mm-hmm.
Great, but give your kids 6 cookies, and 6 cookies may be an exaggeration. Again, if you're going to sue me, that's an estimate, totally for me. I don't get how we sort of portray this as a healthy part of a normal thing to have for breakfast. I don't get it.
But suing this company for thinking that there are berries in the Crunch Berries is just that you're too stupid to live. You deserve what you get.
It points out that if you're an adult, you need to know. You just need to know logically, even if subliminally you're kind of drawn to it. But, does a child know the Crunch Berries aren't berries? Does a 6-year-old know the Crunch Berries aren't berries?
I'm going to tell you that I have a 4-year-old who probably knows that has never had Crunch Berries, but would know that they're not berries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. I accept. In any event, lawsuit, stupid. Captain Crunch, not the most nutritious breakfast, but we'll give Captain Crunch a pass on this one.
Captain Crunch.
There's no berries and there's no captain. That's how fake it is. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking with Kim Severson of the New York Times, one of our favorite food journalists, about the locavore movement, about organic food, and about Michelle Obama's organic garden in the White House. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on 1450 WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today, returning to us again, is one of our favorite food journalists from the New York Times, author of a couple of books, The New Alaska Cookbook and The Transfat Solutions, the award-winning journalist Kim Severson.
Kim, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be back. And I'm just finishing up a third book called Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Kitchen, but that won't be out till the spring, but I did just turn in the manuscript, so I'm feeling awfully happy today.
Well, and we know that then next spring, Kim Severson will be back on the show to talk about her new book.
Yeah, you can't start the shameless self-promotion too soon, apparently.
No.
You know, and there goes my next new book.
No.
Everything I needed to learn, I learned when my mother had her wooden spoon.
You know, did you get that too? My mom, what is that with the Italian moms and the wooden spoon? I don't understand.
My Irish mom used the yardstick, and it always broke, which didn't really hurt, but it made it seem more dramatic.
Yeah.
You know, the Irish and the drama. There you go.
Yeah, I know. Sure. Well, but whether with the yardstick or the spoon, didn't you find there was that moment when your mother was standing at the gateway to the door and she said, you know, Francis Patrick Schott, get in here right now. And you figured to, like, you did a little head fake so she would swing the yardstick or the spoon and then you could scoot right in and she wouldn't get you on the butt on the way in?
You know, mine was trying to beat her up the stairs, like run up the stairs faster than her so she wouldn't get me in the back of the thighs and my shorts.
She comes swinging it after you. Ah, childhood memory.
My mother was...
Good times.
My mom
was...
Recently reminding me of the first time I said, yeah, that doesn't hurt.
It was a mistake. All right, I suggest we talk about food.
Why not?
Kim, we asked you to be on the show again because, well, not like I need a reason to ask you to come on the show because I love talking with you about food, but your recent article in the New York Times in May, called When Local Makes It Big, you raised a lot of, you know, really serious and thoughtful issues. The article for our listening audience was about how Frito-Lay has is sort of co-opting the local food movement. What Frito-Lay did was they got one of their farmers in, was it Florida?
Florida, I think.
Yeah, it was in Florida. On their commercial, he says, we grow potatoes in Florida. Frito-Lay sells potato chips in Florida. Sort of implying, like, I'm a locavore, too.
Right.
And it's patently ridiculous, don't you think?
Well, it's really interesting. It certainly takes the whole local food thing to a new level. And, you know, Frito-Lay, they have, not unlike Hostess, they have local plants that are regional production facilities. So they have some regional growers. Certainly in the Northeast, they buy some potatoes here when it's season. Obviously buy a lot from Idaho. They buy some from Texas, from Florida. So some great marketing person had this idea that they would find a farmer who grows the potatoes in Georgia and Texas and Florida and the places where they do buy Lay's potato chips. Then, you know, there's a Lay's potato chip plant that those potatoes get shipped to not too far away. The end of the equation, Lay's potato chips are local potato chips, which is just, you know, in the line of logic, certainly you could see how they went there. But I think it takes the whole locavore concept pretty far. It's the idea that you could buy a bag of Lay's potato chips and feel like you were eating like a locavore. And that's, you know, this classic American food industry, you know, the sluice box that is the American food industry. You put in something like the locavore concept, shake it through branding and marketing departments, and out come Lay's potato chips, the local choice. I thought it was kind of a very ingenious and also deceptive concept, but you know, it's not unlike what a lot of groceries, Safeway, big grocery stores now will have a local produce sign up. Does it mean that it's got all of the things that local produce, that the people who invented the term locavore wanted it to mean? Sustainable agriculture, small farmers, not very many, if any pesticides at all, organic, a lot of heirloom products. So there's all that stuff that local food meant. It didn't mean being attached to a large corporation, but a lot of you know, it's local now. If you stamp that on a product, it really sells. So I don't know. It's an interesting turn of events.
Kim, it sounds like these marketing branches of these large corporations are kind of like reverse septic systems. You put good stuff in, and well, crap comes out.
That's deep, good. Mark. That's going down in the annals of restaurant guys' lore.
Right. But, you know, somebody, and I have to say, just on the other side of this, you know, the folks at ConAgra that produce Hunt's tomato sauce, for example, Hunt's tomatoes, all of their tomatoes are grown within 150 miles or so, 180 miles or so of the plant in California where they can the tomatoes. So their argument is, you know, if you live in Kansas City, you can't get local tomatoes in the middle of winter, but you can get these tomatoes that were canned locally, that were produced locally, and then shipped to you, which, of course, is not the carbon footprint thing, but you know where your tomatoes are coming from. You know, it's kind of this bigger movement where everybody wants to know where their food comes from now. It's also interesting, like the farm bureaus, Virginia in particular, have this new local food program going, and, you know, the farm bureaus, which represent, I guess, what you call big agriculture, you know, certainly Monsanto is, you know, a friend to a lot of these farms. You know, they're large you know, large farms that are producing food, monoculture food, things that are kind of opposite of the small, low, slow food movement. Anyway, the Virginia Farm Bureau has got a new local food thing going, and their argument is buy Virginia produce, and then you are, you know, avoiding the foreign competition from China that dumps apples in, you know, in the markets in Virginia. So it's a really interesting use of this local concept, very far away from what I think the people who started eating that way wanted it to be.
Doesn't anybody who really understands the term locavore, don't they immediately, isn't this transparent to them what Lay's is trying to do?
Yeah, oh, you'd think so. You'd think so. But you have a lot of people who maybe aren't so versed in food, and they've kind of heard about this local food thing, and they're at the supermarket, and, you know, it might work for some people.
Well, I mean, I think the idea is, once a term, let's compare it with the term organic, you know?
Okay.
Because the same sort of thing happened to organic, is people are trying to co-opt the term organic.
Correct.
To make it mean things that it doesn't mean. And the way it works is, people come out with organic produce, and big agribusiness says, that's ridiculous, it's ridiculous, it doesn't make money, nothing should be organic, you don't have to worry about organics, chemicals are perfectly safe, put them on your dog, eat them, feed them to your child, organic is stupid, 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 stupid. And then people pioneer, and they get a small group of people, and that grows larger and larger, and they demonstrate that there are positive things to organic, and that a segment of the market is going to be attracted to it. And as they get their message out, big agribusiness, which was saying organic is stupid, 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 bad, 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 says, wait. There's money to be made. We can't beat them into submission. Let's take them over. And so they then try and co-opt what the very definition of organic is legally. And now all of a sudden, you know, you have stuff that people are labeling as organic that is very far away from the vision of what people who coined the term wanted it to mean. So it's taking over the language. You know, no one in the local food movement, and locavore is a very specific term, but even the local food movement, ever envisioned that Frito-Lay's potato chips, if you happened to be near the particular factory that they came out of, would be considered, you know, eating well, eating locally, and, you know, somehow supporting a sustainable local food shed. It's just, it's the antithesis,
right,
of it. But, you know, it's technically true that they're locally. It's fascinating and disturbing. And I think the point is to stop it from growing, to take all those people who are just starting to say, hey, you know, what is this local food stuff? Let me look into it. And then they go look into it like, oh, Lay's potato chips. I get to do the same thing I've always been doing and eat Lay's potato chips on my couch, but I get to be a locavore too. I'm a locavore too.
Right. It's like, well, they were in my cupboard. That's local. I'll go get some. Right.
Right. You know, it's like it also harkens back to, and there's a real, you know, I guess we could measure. I mean, you're a journalist. Mark and I are advocates, and we're advocates for sustainable, healthful, tasteful, tasty food. And I think we can maybe in the 17 years we've been in our restaurant, and even since in the 5-6 years since we've been doing this show, you've seen industry start to fight back in these ways, which I guess at least means that we're making a bit of a difference, you know? Does it? Do you think, Kim?
You know, I think the needle has definitely moved. And, you know, you can certainly make the argument that the food industry co-opted organics. And so now, you know, what organic means has been somewhat watered down, and it could have products coming in from other countries that have very little oversight and still stamp their products, the raw materials organic. There's, you know, problems with growing just one kind of crop in the land. There's all kinds of things with it. However, and Gary Hirschberg, who's the head of Stonyfield Organics, makes this point in this new film, Food Inc., although, you know, again, you can have your argument on both sides, that he's got a huge company, Stonyfield Organics, bought by Danone. Still, he is keeping tons, literally tons of pesticides out of the ground by making organic yogurt and dairy products at such a huge scale. And so is that a success, the simple fact that fewer pesticides are being put into the earth? Well, yeah, that doesn't seem like a bad thing to me. And then also, you know, just more moms who, you know, that organic milk, like picking up that organic milk, that moms somehow are making the connection that less processed is better for their child. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's a phenomenon that's a fairly new thing, the last 15 years or so. It's a big cultural shift. I think there's a lot of room for hucksterism. There's a lot of room for manipulation. And I think a lot of people are still, you know, talking the talk but not walking the walk. So they're buying, you know, they're buying a fast food hamburger and not stopping to think, why does this cost a dollar? What possible universe could exist where this hamburger costing a dollar is a healthy thing for anybody? But still they buy it, or people buy it because that's what fills their bellies up, and, you know, it's what a lot of families can afford to eat. So, you know, it's a long way to go before things really change. But, you know, if you look how quickly, you know, it's not been but, you know, 10, 15 years that organics and even the term local has been part of the regular conversation. The farmers markets have grown from 400 or so in the mid-90s to now well over 4,000. So, you know, change is happening, I have to say.
Well, and I think what's interesting, though, is in judging change, the fight back from big corporate agribusiness, who is really fighting back. And another example, I think, of corporate agribusiness fighting back is there's been a real – we've been enemies of high fructose corn syrup for a long time, Mark mm-hmm. and I. And people are raising awareness to where – there people are looking evidently at labels enough – and saying, you know what, I'd rather something with sugar, that a lot of the big companies are changing over from high fructose corn syrup to sugar. Well, the Corn Refiners Association put out, have you seen the commercials on television where
right,
they basically
right, that's
say
so funny.
High fructose corn syrup is great for you. It's just, and they question, you know, they set up a paper tiger. There's two women and they say, and they have a little conversation about, well, so I guess you're going to give your kids high fructose corn syrup. I guess you don't care about your kids. And the other one says, why? And she says, well, haven't you heard? And the other woman says, haven't I heard what? And the woman who supposedly thinks high fructose corn syrup is bad has no answer.
Right. She's totally. That's part of a $30 million campaign. So if, you know, the Corn Refiners Association obviously has to feel threatened if they're spending $30 million basically to set up commercials where the critics of high fructose corn syrup look like complete idiots. It's
well,
just really.
Well, what's funny is the answer is then. You mean that it comes from corn and it's natural and like all things? And the answer is, you know, that's like saying, well, here, you see that those bullets that your kids are playing with? What's wrong with them? Well, you know, gunpowder is natural. It comes from minerals. Lead is dug out of the earth. It's all, you know,
right.
Corn and corn and high fructose corn syrup, very, very, yeah. very different things.
Yeah. Yeah. So and it's, you know, the high fructose corn syrup argument, certainly there's not a lot of, like, the idea that, I mean, there's some, beginning to be some research that shows it does wreak havoc with a metabolic system that, you know, there's issues around insulin resistance that high fructose corn syrup might have an effect. There are also a lot of other studies that show it doesn't really do that much difference to the body than regular sugar, but the problem is there's so much of it in the system, and then it also ties into a whole other argument about corn subsidies and the use of corn products to you know, that so much of our, you know, federal money that should be going to growing healthier food goes into corn production. There's a whole other huge, long argument that you could sit down with somebody and over a few drinks and have a long debate about. But, you know, it's very tough to articulate that in the moment when somebody just, you know, you just sort of intuitively know that it's probably not a good idea to eat this high fructose corn syrup. And articulating it gets a little difficult.
Well, plus, if the woman in the park doesn't have a good answer, there must not be one.
right. That's right. Exactly. Well, we're wrong. Okay.
There's a whole, we did a show where we actually played two commercials side by side. There's a whole set of parody commercials on YouTube.
Oh,
if you
yeah,
looked up high fructose corn syrup,
so funny.
They're great. Where the other person's not a freaking moron, you know, and
right.
and they have an answer.
I think they do one centered on the Nazi party, which is just.
Oh yeah, that's right. Where the parody is. Where,
it's like, so what's wrong with the Nazi party?
It's a social movement based on people getting together to fight for what they believe in. Yeah,
mm-hmm,
that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know.
Oh my God, it's very funny.
I want to take the sort of the state of food today to the next level. I want to talk about. We'll take a quick break. I want to come back and I want to talk about the White House. And the vegetable garden in the White House. Will you come back and talk with us about that?
Great.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Kim Severson, journalist of the New York Times. And we were talking about society and food and agribusiness and how things have changed and the new sort of sensibility. What did you think of Michelle Obama's Victory Garden and the reaction to it? I found them both fascinating.
Well, it is interesting that, you know, the politic around getting a vegetable garden planted in the White House lawn was fascinating, and they even after she planted the garden, or Michelle Obama led the planting of the garden, the kitchen garden, they promised it would be organic and there wouldn't be chemicals. They got a letter from a chemical trade association chiding her for saying chemicals were bad. So it's just really, it's amazing to me that the impact that the First Lady can have on gardening. And now, you know, we had a story in the front page of the cover of our dining section that said just recently talked about all the rooftop gardens that are happening in New York and cities, and everybody I know is just going garden crazy. I do worry that they're going to grow all these vegetables, and many of them don't know how to cook, so I don't know how we're going to get the garden to the table. But it just seems like, you know, that Michelle Obama makes a move, decides that the growing vegetables matters, and a nation goes crazy.
I think, though, that the First Lady's role is largely a symbolic role and a social role, and always has been. And I think it had a proportional impact. And I think we as a nation we're looking for something. And you know, this hits a lot of notes. Like, it reminds us of the Greatest Generation, which we are not. Let me tell you,
you know, the mediocre generation.
We are the mediocre generation at best.
You guys are being generous. We are not the mediocre generation.
And you know, when was the last time there was a Victory Garden in the White House? Was during World War II. And what it says is, in tough times, you know what? We can grow some of our own food. I think it's very empowering for a lot of people, and it was empowering for her to say, you know, it's okay to go get your hands dirty.
I think it's true, and also as it's the same thing with the rise of like handmade food, salamis, things that people like, you know, handcrafted things. It's in this era of you know, digital separation, and we're all sort of texting and online, and the world's going down the tubes financially. Something tangible, something somebody made, has so much more value now. So something that you've grown, it's just that's more important than the latest pair of Nike sneakers these days.
I think one of the things that's happened in the last 40 years is most Americans have become disconnected from their food. One of the reasons you eat the McDonald's cheeseburger for a dollar is because you have no idea from where that comes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really understood it and you really saw the processes that were put into that cheeseburger at McDonald's, you probably, or McNugget, you probably wouldn't eat it. Where on the other hand, growing your own tomato and eating it is a great pleasure. Harvesting your own food, eating it, something that you've grown, that you've nurtured, there's something very pleasant about that.
Mm-hmm.
You bring up a good point, though, Kim, in that, you know, people are growing food who may not even know exactly how to cook. I've seen, and I saw actually on the cover of the food section of the New York Times just last month, the front page was someone pulling a mason jar out of a water bath and canning, and the whole article was on home canning. What do you think? There's a lot of home canning going on?
All right, this is a trend that we noticed. My colleague Julia Moskin wrote that story, and I have a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist in Manhattan. Usually used to buying the latest Prada shoes, who suddenly wrote to me and said, I found some canning equipment on eBay. I think we should start canning. And so I thought, Okay, if it's like trendy with the Chelsea boys now, I don't know what's happening. but this idea that people want to start preserving their food and preserving their bounty, I mean, it makes sense, and I think it's happening for people who really know how to cook. The idea is intriguing. Maybe people haven't had a lot of time to do it, but it takes some dedication and some equipment to can things. But I know they're having friends of mine who are having big canning parties in San Francisco. The apricot crop just came in, and so two or three people got together to can. And it's starting to happen. I don't know how much. I mean, you guys can, right? Don't you can a lot in your restaurant? You know that it's not an easy process. Don't you? You can a lot of stuff, right?
Well, we do actually. We were sort of vexed with the idea of, you know, we try to source locally whenever possible, and when we buy from far away, we do it with a good reason. So, you know, balsamic vinegar from Modena is worth shipping over.
Alaskan king salmon really needs to come from Alaska.
But is the mineral water worth getting from Fiji? I don't think so, you know. So, but when trying to eat locally as much as possible, the question is always, if you're not in California, you know, April is the cruelest month. What do you eat in February, March, April, May, and even June? Well, in June you start to get berries. But what do you eat that locally? How can you eat locally around through the seasons? And we own some pretty nice restaurants that people have to come because the food is great, you know, and then we can talk about. And so the way we decided to deal with that many years ago was to start putting up stuff. When we opened Catherine Lombardi, we put up locally grown tomatoes that are grown for us, picked at our spec.
Okay.
And we put up 5,000 pounds of tomatoes last year.
Almost 8,000 last year.
For the sauce in Catherine Lombardi's, which is always at least a 50% our own tomatoes year-round. But then we also we put up stuff like fruits and the like in liquor often,
mm-hmm.
and we'll make that throughout the year, and we'll use the leftover spiced fruit-infused juice for cocktails.
So you have a liquor juice cocktail. Well, it's not juice, but it's a juice.
Infused.
It's a fruit-infused liquor that can be used in cocktails, and then you can use. And then we're using the fruits in the food, and it's really, really become a great symbiosis of how to use local products from sustainable producers, from little farmers.
The customers, did they respond to it?
They love it.
Absolutely.
They love it. We did some little event where we did we had some nectarines that we put up last year, and in the spring of this year, we took the nectarines that we put up in Cointreau and hard spices and served the nectarines with foie gras. The chef made them with foie gras, and that was the basis of the presentation. And then we made a drink called a redheaded stepchild from the nectarine and hard spice infused Cointreau. That was delicious.
Wow.
And people, you know, you said before, people want to know where their food is coming from. I think what people want is a context, because, you know, for all of our history, we had the context of your food was the food that your parents taught you, or maybe it was your friend's grandmother, and you had a story to your food. Food in a box in a supermarket, it doesn't have a context, which is why I think even in the days of your famous Amos cookies and Dave's cookies, people felt there was a famous Amos somewhere that made their cookies. And
well, there was for a little while.
We want a story.
Right.
Don't you think we want a story?
Right, but I also think people now are more sophisticated to marketing gimmicks and to corporate things. I think they do want to know where their food comes from, but, you know, it's no longer good enough just to have, Betty Crocker or those sorts of corporate images. But that's, you know, it's always been true, and it was the transition between, you know, somebody making a cake and now here's a cake mix. How are we going to sell people that this cake mix is as valuable as a homemade cake? Well, we'll, number one, we'll convince women that housework is drudgery.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that's convenient is going to free them. So now we're going to make this cake mix. You still have to, you know, put an egg in it or whatever, feel like you're. And then we'll give it this image. We'll find Aunt Jemima, or we'll find Betty Crocker. And so it does still feel homey while we're figuring out ways to sell you cake mix. It's just amazing, you know. And I think people now are more sophisticated. They realize they're not. That they really, you know, authenticity is not easy to come by. So, but people are much more sophisticated. They kind of understand and see through, and that the whole transparency in the food world is stunning. I think people don't fall for the gimmicks anymore. You know,
I was always partial to Mrs. Butterworth.
Were you? Okay, because it talked in the commercial.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, no, I have a story that speaks to both co-opting of a name once you put it out there, and what we're talking about is there's a story circulating, and I don't know if it's true, so please don't sue me if you hear this story. You know Dave's cookies, they were really great cookie brand years ago, and they were run by a guy named Dave who made great cookies. And I had them when they were Dave's cookies. They were delicious. Anyway, Dave sold, and he sold to a guy who promised he'd keep up the standards, blah, 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 blah. Well, a year later, all the fresh ingredients are, you know, let's just say the ingredients list has changed and the cookies are nothing like they were. And Dave runs into the guy who bought his company, who wasn't returning his calls, and he said, "What did you do to my cookies? What did you do to the cookies that have my name on them?" And the guy pulled Dave aside and he said, "Dave, I want to tell you something. You are really great at making cookies, and I am really great at making money." and so Dave's cookies are not what Dave's cookies were, but you know what?
They make a lot of money.
But they do make a lot of money.
There you go.
We need to take another quick break.
This is the problem. I mean, seriously, you know, there have been studies where there just isn't enough land in this country. There isn't enough, you know, to feed the amount of people we need to feed, and to do it at a price that people that, you know, can afford it. You know, we can't all pay $7 a pound for a chicken, or we can't all pay, you know, $14 a gallon for special, you know, raw milk. Like, how are we going to do it? You know, how there's money. Money has to be involved here somewhere. So,
Well, I think the first thing is we don't have enough farmers more than we don't have enough land. I think that trying to have to have, you know, 2,000-acre farms where all we grow is corn is part of the issue.
I also think that, you know, I'm not convinced on the whole argument that, you know, we need, you know, genetically modified agribusiness high-density crops in order to feed everybody. Because with the genetically modified stuff, so far it's turned out that it's on average acre for acre no more productive. It hasn't met any of its promises of increased productivity. It's just you get to use less pesticides because it's pesticide resistant, and it's more uniform. I don't know. I'm not buying it. I have always felt, and you know, I've read like anybody else. I'm not an expert in this field, but we've had some folks on the show who make the case that look, there's plenty of food. It's not a production problem, it's a distribution problem. It's that, you know, people are hungry because there's plenty of food rotting while other people go hungry. And we're paying farmers not to farm land. All around the world, farmers are being paid to leave land fallow. So I think that's a corporate line that we must have these evils in order to do it. And my other line, of course, and you're right, the $14 organic chicken from the farmer's market cannot be, if you have a large family, what you feed your family on. I'm with you on that. But overall, I think you can eat pretty well for a little bit more money. And, you know, what I say to people is, yes, if you spend the same amount of money, you will have to buy less food. Fortunately, we're fat as hell. you know what I mean? We have an obesity epidemic. And we eat too much food anyway.
Well, and also we've got to look back historically too. We spend, pardon me, we spend less money now than we ever have in the history of mankind.
As a percentage of our income.
As a percentage of our income. We have never spent this little on our food as we do right now.
Right. And that's true.
And I think that's coming out in our food.
Right.
So, which means that if our food doubled, we're paying about half what we paid 25 years ago for our food as a percentage of our income, which means that if food prices doubled, that would probably be a more historically realistic amount to be spending on food.
Maybe home prices should shrink and food prices should double. Maybe that's what should happen.
And I think that's kind of what's happening, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. Heavens to Betsy. Well, let's talk about the economy when we come back on the other side. Let's take a quick break. And I want to talk about the economy and restaurants. You write for The Times, and you have a lot of experience in restaurants. I want to talk about restaurants in Brooklyn and Manhattan and New Jersey and how the current economic situation is affecting those. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Kim Severson of the New York Times. The topic we wanted to touch on at least briefly is the economy. Interesting how this economy is playing out in the world of restaurants. What are you seeing in New York?
Well, I think, we went through the first cut, which was the big expensive bottles of wine were gone. Some of the private parties dropped off. That sort of thing. But, you know, people, they're going out. I mean, I think it's a little easier to get a reservation at 8 o'clock than it used to be. But, you know, the places that are hot are still hot. You still can't get a table at Minetta. You still can't, you know, you can't get into, John Dory. Some of the new places are still tough to get into. But I think everybody's talking about smaller overall check tab sizes. But, you know, the mid-range places that are that you can kind of go and gather and, you know, maybe have a couple of interesting appetizers and some drinks are just jammed. I think people are still at that level going out. But I also think that things are a little worse for restaurant owners than they might be letting on. I don't think anybody wants to say, you know, we're bleeding here, you know, because the minute, nobody wants to jump on a sinking,
right, yeah,
sinking boat. So I think the truth is probably a little worse than we're hearing. What's your take on it?
It's interesting. I think the thing that's happened more than anything is obviously restaurants down. I've heard numbers of 40% down. We're nowhere near that, but we've heard colleagues who've been down 40% over last year.
Yeah.
But there are some places that are doing okay. We're, thank heaven, doing okay. I think a lot of that has to do with having deep roots in the community. We've been around for 17 years, so,
I also think that there's a way to combat this that restaurants have, or the good restaurants, I think, moved into pretty quickly. One of the things that's happening in the restaurant world, at the same time that our income is going down, a lot of our costs are coming down too on the other side. And frankly, I think that's saving a lot of restaurants from really going into distress. That all of a sudden, yes, your expenses are that your expenses are going down while your income is going down, and so maybe it's not at the same ratio, but it's keeping a lot of people going.
It's a mitigating factor.
Exactly.
Well, I think a large question for me is the guys who just recently opened restaurants that they borrowed $5 million, $7 million, $10 million for, because those numbers don't go down. I mean, you still got to pay that back. So that's what would give me the greatest trepidation. And for what we see is unpredictability, you know? I mean, some nights are crazy busy. Other nights are slow for no reason. Lots of last-minute reservations. People, instead of booking 2 weeks out, they book 2 days out. So it's a different world. The other thing that we found, though, is the applicant pool for employees, and we do a lot of hiring in this now through the fall because our busy season is in September. The quality of the applicant pool, people looking for restaurant jobs,
no question,
is the highest I've ever seen it.
And the number of applications is the highest I've ever seen it. We just did a little bit of a hiring where we hired four or five entry-level service staff and had 250 applications for four positions.
Huh.
Yeah, which is unusual. And then, I think that's I don't want to say that's an upside.
Well, we had a piece in our a paper recently about the crush for it was at the Jersey Shore, and the crush for job applicants. They had people coming in who in crazy amounts of experience doing all kinds of things. And it was you're going to be cooking frying fish at the shrimp box for $7.50 an hour, and there were families with kids, people who had job experience doing medical record keeping, other sorts of things, who were thought they'd go down to the beach, get just this job for the summer, hang out, let the recession pass, and they no way to employ all this. A friend of mine who opened a really groovy grass-fed beef hot dog place called Let's Be Frank in San Francisco. Just opened it recently. It's kind of a boutique-y hot dog place. You know, jobs frying these hot dogs. I mean, they make their own sauerkraut. It's a kind of high-end, but still, it's a hot dog stand. And it's breaking his heart. He's got guys with Culinary Institute degrees, mm-hmm. you know, $50,000 worth of debt, and they're willing to come and fry hot dogs for him. He said it's just heartbreaking to see what's coming through the door now.
I had a woman a couple of weeks ago come in who has had a great job, you know, had a great job in human resources, and now she applied for a hostess job. You know, that's just where the marketplace is.
Right. Yeah, it'll be tough to see. And, you know, meanwhile, you see things that are like sales of frozen pizzas, for example, is way up. So I think that around the margins, like pizza delivery, maybe that Tuesday night takeout Chinese you might have, those are the places I think people are cutting back. And, you know, delivery jobs and those kind of lower-end line cook jobs, you know, at the Chinese restaurant, the pizza delivery guy, those are the jobs I think that are really have gone away, you know, up at the level y'all are at or higher end. I think it's, you know, still holding on. I think the stuff we're not seeing is that lower level.
You know, I think one of the things about this whole in this economy, we are having people come in, and we're doing pretty well in this economy. We're doing very well.
I hope you're knocking on your wooden desk, my friend.
I knock on my head every day, and
here,
I just
here at WCTC, there's not a ton of wood.
I hope and pray. But the one thing that I have noticed is we have regular customers, like I said, deep roots in the communities, and they'll come in. Maybe people we haven't seen in a while, mm-hmm. and they'll say stuff to us, stuff like, yeah, because Mark and I are often on the floor, at least in the building, and we'll come and say hello to everybody. And they'll say, yeah, you know, my wife and I were thinking where we're going to go out, and we decided to drive down here because we want to make sure you guys are okay. And I think they're coming here because they want to be sure that at the end of this recession, this restaurant is still standing. And I think that sort of loyalty, it's amazing. I've seen that from more than one occasion. I've heard that. It breaks my heart. It makes me want to cry. It's beautiful.
Terrific.
So,
well, you guys must be doing something right.
Yeah, well, and if you have a favorite restaurant that you like, that you think is really great or is important to you in your life out there in listener land, go to that restaurant and buy something.
Okay,
have
is.
A little dinner and enjoy it. Hey, Kim, thanks for coming on the show. It was great to have you as always.
Well, it's my pleasure, guys. Take it easy out there. Good luck with the summer canning season.
Thanks, Kim.
Okay, bye-bye.
You can read more about Kim Severson on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and check out her stuff in the New York Times almost weekly. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis.
Francis, you hit on something at the end of that segment that I want to reiterate. And it's not just about restaurants. It's got to be about your little local pharmacy, your little local deli, whatever the case may be. It's tough times right now. The places that you want to see there at the end of this recession, you need to go out and support. And if that means not going to Home Depot and going to your local little hardware store, and you know, maybe he doesn't have it one out of four times when you go, the exact thing that you need, you know, that's what you need to do. If you want to preserve the little in-town movie theater, if you want to preserve those things, if you want them here at the end of this, you've got to go out and support those little places.
Mark, it's all choked up when he talks about this.
I do.
Yes, indeed you do. Couldn't agree more. In a rare moment, I have nothing to say. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour with The Restaurant Guys. I know that we certainly have. This is Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.